And good evening, everyone. Welcome again to the Open Paddock Podcast. I'm Mike, and unfortunately, Sean will not be joining us this evening. But joining me this evening is a man who's just at his wit's end with the thought that Lotus is just going to do so poorly in this 500, so much so that he's lost hair over it. Doug Patterson.
Hello. That wasn't the only reason why I lost hair.
Yeah. It seems it was a bit warm at the track this weekend, and Doug, yeah.
Yeah, the last time I got my hair cut was, well, about this time last year. So it had been a year since my last visit to the barber. And, well, being an astronomer, and, you know, winters in the Midwest being what they are, and our observatory is five stories on top, up on top of the science building there at Johnson County Community College. It's cold up there, and I like having the insulation. But, you know, when it's an air temperature in the high 80s, and you're standing on tarmac that has a, that's sitting there at a temperature in the high 120s, yeah, that insulation is not so nice. And so I went to a local Sport Clips here and said, chop it off. And she was like,
wow.
Really? How much? like
number two on the sides, number four on the top.
Well, that's
sideburns.
Actually a friend of mine who's in the Navy. He offered to actually pay for not just this haircut, but for the next one as well, if I got it cut like his, a nice high and tight. And I'm like, ooh, I'm enough of a cheapskate that it tempted me. You're like, no, I can't do that, man.
Oh, my. Well, and you with just a little extra insulation on top were uncomfortable, but you weren't wearing a fire suit this weekend.
No.
You definitely are not going to be wearing one next weekend.
Oh, hell no.
With the forecast high at Indianapolis being, at this point, on Tuesday night, 97 degrees.
Holy crap.
It's going to be a hot race day. So if you're coming to the track, number one, think very carefully about what you bring with you. I would say the alcohol stays home and the water comes with. I would say a large cooler filled with ice water and frozen bottles of water just to make sure they stay cool for the day, washcloths and all that kind of stuff to keep you cool, sunblock galore, loose-fitting clothing. Yeah.
Yeah, all the above. All the above. And you know, normally, you know, beer is the mainstay for us, although we were entertaining the idea of switching it up to margaritas.
Ooh.
For race day. And then we saw the forecast, like,
You know? Save the margaritas for the after-race celebration about 8:30
after
you've recovered.
We will be bringing in mass quantities of water. Because, man, it's going to be – this is on track to be the hottest Indianapolis 500-mile race in on record. We had one of these, 2 years ago, and it was incredibly brutal. That was only, in the low 90s?
Yeah.
You know, 'cause this is 97 degrees ambient air temperature out in a normal place, okay? We're going to be sitting on top of a bunch of concrete and asphalt. Mm-hmm. On aluminum bleachers with no shade. It's going to be brutal. This is a genuine concern. I'm sure that the medical staff the first responder staff there at IMS are really preparing and gearing up for a lot of overheating, heat stroke, dehydration issues on Sunday. I think this is going to keep the crowd size down. I know a lot of people were interested in coming out and seeing the new cars and hearing the new engines, but man, you know, it even had you know, if I hadn't already driven 550 miles, if I was from the area here, I would really have second thoughts. As much of a fan of the 500 as I am, I would have to think very carefully about this.
Well, you know, we at least in the stands have some relief from it because, you know, we can go under the stands if it's too bad.
True, you can go underneath.
We have the ability to hydrate, you know, to make sure that we do the right things going leading into the race to make sure that we're ready to watch this event in the heat. But you know what? The drivers, they're going to have a rough day, but especially the pit crews. I mean, that's just got to be brutal standing down there because you're not moving. I mean, yeah, you can say that a driver strapped into a car is you know, it's not air conditioning.
No, yeah, in spite of the Honda commercial, which is absolutely funny. I love it.
Yeah,
Mario
yeah.
Andretti, air conditioning. No, it really isn't.
Even beyond that, the guys in the pit crew are just going to be, it's going to be brutal.
Yeah.
Especially
you got to keep that helmet on at all times, you know, because you never know when someone is going to come in, and even if it's not your person, you got to be ready.
Yeah. And that's especially going to be difficult for some of the part-time pit crews.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, at least some of the full-time pit crews do training and everything to try and be in shape for something like this. But, wow. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting weekend.
Well,
and
there's the infield. You know, the people there in the Turn 3 infield.
I think
there is no respite from the sun.
Yeah, and I think the infield is going to be way down this year, just exactly what you were saying. And that's the area I think the crowd is going to be hurt the most because a lot of these seats are paid for a year ago.
True.
And people are probably going to show up at least for part of the race.
Yeah.
But the infield is going to be hurt.
Yeah.
But anyway, that is overstepping what happened last weekend to talk about what's going to happen this coming weekend. We do need to talk about what happened leading up to qualifying, a little bit about qualifying, and definitely our picks for the race.
Yes.
Beyond that, we're going to talk a little bit about Road to Indy, talk about the night before the 500, and the Firestone Freedom 100 at the Speedway coming Friday. Doug's favorite day of the year.
Absolutely.
The Acropolis Rally is hitting this weekend for you WRC fans, so we will briefly preview that. There's a few things going on in F1 that we at least want to give brief mention to, specifically Monaco's this weekend. And, you know, last weekend we talked about how France, because the elections didn't go the way they wanted, it doesn't look like they're going to have a race anytime soon. Well, this weekend we're talking about maybe the same thing happening in Sochi. So, very interesting stuff. But that, again, is putting the cart before the horse because the horse this week is the Indy 500, and it gets prime billing on tonight's show. So, Doug, let's talk about one thing that happened last week that kind of got my ire up early. Lotus was having trouble with John Alesi because they could not get him through ROP. They got through the first two stages of ROP, but the third phase of ROP required him to go above 210, 210 to 215 for, 10 laps?
Yeah, something like that. He had to maintain race pace, basically.
And to this date, that hasn't happened, according to some reports. Not officially.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say that DeSilvestro is kind of in the same boat. I mean, she was a bit quicker, but, I mean, you know, it's still, you know, getting it up to speed, you know, above the 210 for qualifying, as we all know, is very different than getting up to speed for race trim. Mm-hmm. You know, because qualifying trim, you're white knuckling it for those four laps.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to be doing that for 200. You will find the wall. Your concentration will lapse at some point, and you just can't dance on that razor's edge that long. You know, and so the cars in race trim are set to be a little bit more forgiving, I guess might be the best word, a little bit more stable, so you don't have to white knuckle it all the time.
Yeah. Jeez.
But, you know, this is certainly not an issue with Alesi. this is definitely an issue with the Lotus engine.
Yeah, it came to a head with Alesi because he had the finish ROP where Simona did not.
Right.
And to get Alesi through ROP and to get Simona a level of comfort with the car, IndyCar allowed Lotus on was it Thursday or was it Wednesday? I can't remember. Either one of those days, they allowed Lotus to go ahead and increase the boost to the level that they were going to allow for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for Fast Friday through the end of qualifying.
Right, the 1.5 bar extra boost
mm-hmm.
that they ran, which, by the way, they are, if I'm reading this right, the boost levels will remain at 130 kilopascals for the 500.
Yeah, IndyCar came through just this evening and said that the cars will all race at the same boost level. So Lotus is not going to be given a bonus boost. I think it went from 130 to 140 bar, or say, excuse me, 130 to 140 psi for qualifying. And they will have to go back to the regular amount of boost. And that was actually a bone of contention that they were even considering letting Lotus run the race at the higher boost while everybody else had to run at the lower boost.
Yeah, no, they should not do that.
I was shocked they were even considering it.
Well, why? No, seriously. I mean, if you think about how some of the decision making mm-hmm. has gone in recent years, there has been this movement more towards making decisions based on the show, the entertainment, rather than based on the sport. I think this is a good sign that we're starting to see a reversal of that, at least in part, back to really enforcing this as a sport and not as a sport first and entertainment second, rather than flip-flop.
Now, whatever the decision-making process was, stories came out even as early as Sunday talking about the idea that IndyCar was going to consider the idea of giving Lotus that boost for good. And I have no idea what naked pictures does Lotus have of IndyCar officials that even made them think about this. I mean,
well, you know, I'm okay with them considering it. You know, you can throw a bone to Lotus and say, we'll look at this, and then you can meet in a little conference room for 5 minutes and say, we're not going to do this, are we? Nope.
Yeah.
Okay, meeting over.
Well, here's how it would have gone down with the teams. Roger Penske would have protested.
Yep.
And there would have been another.
Would have been right behind you.
Well, and everybody at the rear of the field would too, and they rightfully would be, because if there's any chance that any of those Lotus cars, those underpowered, ridiculously funded, stupid Lotus cars, would have a chance of finishing ahead of a legitimate contender in this race, then that's a fallacy and it shouldn't happen. So.
Well, and think of the uproar from
yes.
given their performance was relative to the Chevrolet engine.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would have been like, hey, whoa, what about us?
You know, yeah. We'll get into that. I'm very interested to talk about the performance difference between the two actual engine manufacturers in the series.
Yeah.
but before we dig into that, let's talk about Dragon, because they had one heck of a week.
Oh yeah.
Through practice, because they did not practice. They did not practice all the way up until Thursday when they secured release from Lotus somehow and got Chevy engines. If you recall,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
They filed a $4.6 million lawsuit against Lotus for fraud.
Right. Yeah. This isn't dereliction of contract or breach of contract.
Yeah.
This is contractual fraud. I mean, this is a serious lawsuit.
And I don't know if it's been dropped. I haven't heard anything as to the terms of, you know, what happened that made Lotus agree to allow Dragon to go away. Because at the end of it, Lotus had to let them out of their contract.
they promised not to sue them for $8 million?
That could be. I mean,
I have no idea. And, you know, there's been some dark speculation as to just what kind of bone Lotus was thrown for allowing Dragon out of their deal.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard the speculation. There's nothing behind it other than speculation, but there are a lot of people that are chatting about, did IndyCar actually do a deal with Lotus to ensure that none of the other manufacturers would give engines to anybody else to bump Lotus out of the field?
I think there's a little bit more to it than just mere speculation. Whether the rumor that's been floating around, is true in all of its details or not, I don't know. But I'm fairly convinced there is some shadiness involved here. And I don't know that we'll ever get the full story. Not anytime soon, anyway. But yeah, there's some bad business going on here. Because as we talked about last week, for certain, Foyt was ready to just jump right in and say, I'll put in two cars.
Yeah, exactly.
And, he supposedly had a car or two for Howard and perhaps Vitor. I never saw Vitor this weekend. He might have been around, and I just never saw him. I definitely saw Jay Howard.
Yeah.
But
Pippa Mann supposedly tweeted out this weekend that she had a car, a team, and an engine all lined up.
Yeah, I had heard that as well.
So, there is some speculation. Don't know if there's truth behind it or not.
I think it's now a matter of how much truth. I think there's a little bit. I don't know.
In the end, you and I talked about this before the podcast. It's kind of a function of how quickly everything was rushed into engine packages and car packages, the Dallara for this season and everything like that. Things were rushed to make sure that we had a new package this season, and I'm perfectly happy with that. Some due diligence wasn't done. If due diligence was done on Lotus, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation. Maybe things were rushed when they wrote the lease contracts with the manufacturers that made it more difficult for them to ask them to provide more engines. But even then, you look at it, Chevy's providing 17, Honda's providing 14.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy ridiculous.
Well,
compared to what they were fighting over when they were talking about adding an 11th car.
That was much earlier, too.
That's true.
Keep in mind, that was earlier, and, as we get later and later in the season, production lines will become more efficient, more parts are going to be available, these engines are going to be easier to start cranking out as they get more, the production process gets more and more developed. I'm, now that we're here right on the cusp of the 500, I'm not too surprised about the level of participation that Chevy and Honda have shown themselves capable of providing.
Well, certainly. I think it goes to show how much they're partnering with the league on this. At the beginning of the season, they were providing, 10, 11 engines each?
Right. That's what they planned on.
And as they were, they saw the need and they ramped up.
Yeah.
They saw the need for Indy and they ramped up because they knew that the extra cars were not going to come from Lotus. And in fact, Lotus shed cars going into Indy to make it an even more untenable situation for these engine manufacturers.
Yeah.
Very interesting how this has all worked out. All that said, I'm very excited about what we're going to see on Sunday. I was a little less excited about what happened last weekend, mainly because the bump day that was pretty much, almost like single lap qualifying like they used to do, the four lap qualifying they did a couple of years ago to make it like Indy, where they went out one at a time, put their times up, and then they were done, at the other oval tracks.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what bump day was. They all went out there, put up their time, and they were done because there was no fear that their cars would be bumped from the field.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you had cars going out there like Brian Clausen on bump day, went out there, in race trim, not even trying to set up a quick time. And, you know, this is Indy, and I know that this is a function of what happened and the system that took place this year, but it wasn't on the ragged edge, and it's a little concerning. But you can understand from their standpoint, they didn't have another car.
Yeah.
So, anyway. So, Jean-Luc Lacy, he pretty much all but called himself a danger to the rest of the field due to the Lotus engine.
You know, I can't agree, or I can't disagree with him.
Yeah.
In fact, in one of my articles earlier this week, I think it was on my Bump Day recap, I had posed the question where people thought the line would be for you know, for the over under on when the first Lotus would get lapped. Now I was sitting there thinking of the speed differential and the fact that the Lotus, you know, the two Lotus machines were going to be starting probably at least half a straightaway, if not, you know, two-thirds of a straightaway behind the leaders at the start of the race. You know, if they wouldn't be lapped by lap eight, that's where I put my over-under line. Gentleman on the IndyCar Garage, the forums over there, made a very good point. I think this was Railroad that did this. I don't have... I have it pulled up right now, but anyway, he had made the think correct assessment that you could probably expect a caution period within the first five laps.
Wow.
And well, no, that's, you know, that's kind of part and parcel with a lot of 500s, right?
Fair enough.
You know, yeah. It's not too surprising, and I didn't factor that into my calculations when I set the line at eight. And he had set the line, assuming there's going to be a yellow, he set it at 15. I'm like, you know, that's really not a bad, that's really not bad thinking right there. That's pretty sharp. So.
Yeah, I mean, here's how it's going to go down. It's going to go down just like it happened with Milk Duno and Marty Roth, or at least it should. When the pack is catching up to those cars, IndyCar needs to get on the horn. Mr. Bo Barfield needs to express his race control attitudes and tell them to bring it in, see if they can get the car up to speed, go back out. If they're not back up to speed, they're going to be black flagged and removed from the event.
Yes. And that's a certainty.
Yeah.
They have already came out and said if, you know, explicitly if they're not able to maintain 105% of the leaders' lap times, you know,
yeah,
the competitive lap times, and they're going to get black flagged. And I think that happens before lap 50. Wouldn't be surprised if it happens before lap 30.
I totally agree. The only way that Milka and Marty were able to go farther on some occasions were they would basically wait until they were getting close to being lapped and then just bring it into the pits before they're told to go into the pits. They'd get out of the way and then come back out on clear track.
Right.
So that's a possibility, but you gotta understand, everybody out there, this is so damaging to Lotus. I mean, they're in a ridiculously bad situation. They put themselves in it.
Yeah. I have no sympathy for them.
Their very own brand ambassador, Jean Alesi, a guy that's on the Lotus payroll, Crash.net has an article where somebody asked him if Jean Alesi was considering pulling out of the 500 in advance of qualifying this weekend, and Alesi said, "It's not impossible. The equipment is just too slow. I think especially the engine."
Yes.
Your brand ambassador is throwing you under the bus because he doesn't want to look like a complete fool out there.
Right. Well, he's being honest. He's calling it as it is.
Yeah, and Simone right next to him is vetting that out. It's not like Jean Alesi's out there just putting in inept lap times.
Right.
Everybody know, you know, you look at Simona and you know that she's a very capable driver. This is not something that, you know, that they've got. Anyway, you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
So, ouch, because you still have this situation. Lotus is shedding engine partners. Dragon's gone. Herta's gone. Who was the other one? brain's not working. Brian Reinbold. So you got four cars that have left your program. The two that are left, one of them is your very own brand ambassador saying these cars are just too slow, and you're going to get pulled from the Indianapolis 500 because your product is uncompetitive. So all of those things together, I would say it was a pretty bad idea for Lotus to get into IndyCar, wouldn't you?
Yes. Let me back up. Where the ultimate bad decision was made, it wasn't getting into IndyCar. It was getting into IndyCar and Formula One and GT racing and trying to make a prototype, sports car racer. And they also have the single mark, Evora. Is that right? Was that the Evora Cup that they were, or something like that? So you've got.
And then beyond that, they're talking about rolling out four new models in the next, like, 5 or 4 years or something like that.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, and we beat this to death, but, the original bad decision was overextending, overreaching with their motorsports marketing strategy. We said it before, looking at their production volume, there's no way you can justify this. There really isn't. Was it bad that they got into IndyCar? Not per se. The bad decision was trying to do too much, too fast, and too all at once, too simultaneous. If they had just focused on IndyCar, or if they'd not gotten IndyCar and just focused on Formula One, or just focused on sports car, they might have been much better off. But as it is, they tried to do everything, and they've been doing everything mediocrely instead of doing just a couple of things or one thing very well. And that's where the failure was made. By the way, speaking of John Alesi, saw a photo today, and I got to give a shout out to Mark Beaver. Beaver Photography, BEVER Photography.com. Go to his website, click on the 2012 Indy 500 gallery that he has, and I forget what page this is on. He's got a ton of really good photos, but this is towards the back, I think. There is a shot. He was in the Lotus Garage for a time, and there's a headshot, a profile shot that he has of John Alesi that is really magnificent. It is a high quality photograph. It's super, super cool. I'm ultra jealous of his mad skills now. It was a really, really nice image. So anyway, make sure to go to his site and check that out. I'm done with Alesi.
Sweet. Well, unfortunately, we've started out the show talking about the negatives, and there will probably breach on some more. But let's talk about the people who did things right.
Yes.
Going into poll day, obviously, you're going to be talking about the people who did things right because you won't qualify in the top 24 if you're not among them. Mm-mm. And, as the current format is, the top 24, set their, top 24 speeds on poll day, set their time into the field, set their position in the field, except the top 9 who go into a 1.5 hour shootout session to see who can get the quickest time to get the pole. What fun. I don't know. What do you think about that format? Just a quick thought, Doug.
I like it. I kind of like it. It adds a little bit of drama to poll day, that's been kind of lacking. The thing about poll days of the past is not only were you looking for just people to set the poll, but you were also looking for speed records. People just going out there and surprising someone with just a mad burst of speed, and hearing Tom Carnegie, it's a new track record.
Yeah.
You remove that from the equation, so all you have is the fight for pole. Pole day loses a little bit of its luster, right? And so I think this is a good fix. I really do.
Well, let me be honest. I think one of the reasons you weren't seeing the end of the day runs making a difference, because I think that's part of it as well. I think the end of the day runs weren't the pole setting runs for several years in a row, and that's because of daylight savings time.
Yes.
When it used to be that pole day lasted until 7 p.m. Eastern, which would have been 6 p.m. Indiana dumb time.
I know. I enjoy not having daylight savings. You can't legislate how many hours are in a day.
Yeah. Anyway, it was kind of an interesting situation because from 6 to 7, you had the long shadows over the track, and the track was the coolest it had been all day.
Yeah, you had that happy hour, you know, and you don't have that anymore. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But I still like the format that they have. The
format makes the best of it. But whatever, let's talk about the meat of the day. One of the storylines through the weekend was, hey, Honda's, you know, for the whole week, Honda's been given this dispensation on the turbo. BorgWarner was allowed to increase the intake on the turbo. And Chevy was concerned that Honda got an unfair advantage. And through practice, you didn't see, or at least I felt, you didn't see a Honda dominance in the practice, or a Chevy dominance in the practice. In fact, Honda had the quick time on several of the days out of Sarah Fisher's team, so maybe that should have told us something. However, when it went to pole day, when it went to Fast Friday and into pole day, there was one Honda in the Fast 9 on Saturday.
And it was Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing.
Yeah.
Joey Newgarden. How about that?
That's fantastic. I mean, just phenomenal for that team. To be the one Honda injury, the entry that seems to have things sorted. And, you know, beyond that, Brian Clausen, when he put it in the wall, he was doing some pretty respectable lap times on Saturday.
Yes, and man, that was a brutal hit.
Yeah, it was. Now, Brian wasn't the only one that ended up in the wall, though. Brian put it in the wall. Ed Carpenter put it in the wall.
Oh,
and,
I was intern, too, when that happened.
Oh, yeah?
Put up a couple of shots there in the photo gallery. One of them just starting to lose it, and another one after he had hit the wall. Oh, that sounded... It was gut wrenching, you know, the sound that made when it hit. But you know, you look at the hits, both from Clausen, from Ed Carpenter, and who was it, Servia that hit the
Oriel Servia hit the attenuator.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of Kevin Coogan. if you remember back in the 80s when he bounced off that inside wall and demolished the camera that was there at the attenuator, just chopped his car in half, it reminded me exactly of that. But in all three of those cases, and in another incident we saw, Charlie Kimball on bump day had a nasty little hit too.
Mm-hmm.
All the cars stayed upright.
Yeah.
There were no flips, and that's a great thing to see.
That is a good thing to see. There was a little concern because when the car made their initial hit with the outside wall, it looked like the car tipped towards the wall a bit.
Yes.
And I think that's just a function of the bodywork, the way the bodywork crumples and how it's got that hard, I don't know if you want to call it a legality plank or whatever, but the under tray of the car that extends proud of the chassis.
Yeah.
Once that hits, you know, that becomes the pivot point.
Great engineering term.
What's that?
Proud.
Oh, nice.
I like that. Very well done.
Well, I was going to throw out another one. Once that part of the chassis that stands proud of the wheels, once that hits the outside wall, it becomes the pivot point, too.
Yes, yes.
And that seemed to be what was picking it up and pushing it up towards the wall. So I'm a little concerned about that, but we can't make a mountain out of just a few crashes.
And,
so,
you know, after seeing the sequence that I shot of Ed, I see exactly what you're saying and the concern. But you know, the previous chassis, you would have been up and over and landing on your lid. You know,
fair enough.
So, by the way, if you want to know what the under tray and the gallery plank actually look like, check out our gallery. I have a picture of Ed's right there. You can it's nice and
nice.
It's a little cracked. But
a little banged up. Yeah, I mean, mentioning Brian Clausen, they said that Sarah Fisher's team was up throughout the night to like 3:30 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
Getting the car back together, getting it ready to go out there for its bump run. And rough time, because while there are some spare chassis out there, there aren't many.
No, and you know they had just enough time to put the body panels on the car and slap some decals on the bare carbon fiber. there was no paint. Most of the rearward body panels on Clausen's car were just raw carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So mad props to them for just getting the car together, and then Clausen going out and turning some great laps to put the car in the field.
Yeah, especially with it being a car that, you haven't really practiced with, you haven't done much with, mm-hmm. you've thrown it together, and, he qualified at a 214, which, given the fact that he was in race trim, that's not so bad.
No, not bad at all.
So, but, for pole day, I mean, we haven't even said his name yet. Ryan Briscoe.
We hadn't been saying his name all month long.
No.
You know? And all of a sudden, bam.
Yeah, and what's funny is, the Indianapolis Star got into a little bit of heat because their headline was Ryan Briscoe just barely wins the pole over James Hinchcliffe.
Well, he did just barely get it. I mean, okay, I did some quick arithmetic, and first of all, the speeds are incredibly close. Three thousandths of a mile per hour.
Yeah, 0.484 to 0.481, 226.484 to 226.481.
Now, and this is over four laps, right? Mm-hmm. So over four total laps around the 2.5 mile oval, the James Hinchcliffe was shy of Briscoe's speed or Briscoe's total time. Briscoe's total time was 2:38, or 38.9514 seconds. So 2:38.9514 seconds. James Hinchcliffe, four laps, 2:38.9537. That is. That is 23 ten-thousandths of a second. 23 ten-thousandths of a second over four laps. So that is – they don't deserve heat because he did just barely get pole. But, I mean, the point is he got pole. He's the one taking the trophy home for – and he's the one that gets to lead the field of 33 to the green flag on Sunday.
Yeah, it's – it's fairly interesting that he was able to pull that out because nobody was talking about him all month.
I was convinced that it was going to be Castro Neves. I really did.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was convinced Castro Neves was going to be up there. I was convinced Dixon was going to be up there too. And
I kind of thought he would have been doing better than he did.
Yeah, Dixon qualified 15th. Dario qualified 16th. That is behind Charlie Kimball, Graham Rahal, looking for other Hondas, Alex Pagliani, Joe Newgarden. I mean, several people qualified in front of the targets.
Well, I think it's especially telling that the JV squad, maybe it's a bit of a disservice calling them that. The new addition to the Target Chip Ganassi family.
Yeah,
about that. Is that a more politically correct? But anyway, the JV squad, Graham Rahal and Charlie Kimball, they outqualified the very seasoned veterans and champions, Scott Dixon and Dario Franchitti. Now, I don't think that either one of us is going to sit here and lay claim that Rahal and Kimball are superior drivers to Dixon and Franchitti.
Yeah.
Not to say that that Rahal and Kimball aren't very good drivers. They are. However, I mean, we're talking about Dixon and Franchitti here, right? So what is up with the varsity squad, with the Target cars? Especially the number 10 team, or I guess this week it's the number 50 team. Was that for the 50th anniversary of Target? Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
So anyway, you know, Dario has really struggled this year. What's up with that? What gives?
Well, I think it all goes back to that trophy with the naked man.
Naked man on a unicycle?
Yeah, I think it all comes back to that. In fact, I think Dario is going to give that trophy up to the to be given away to one of the three participants of the last row party.
Nice.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know, man. That's surprising. Now, this kind of brings up something that I was wondering. You go through the month, and there was a back and forth with the lap times. I mean, the target cars got up there on a few of the days.
They did, especially Dixon.
And, you know, the Penske's were kind of not really making much of a showing, except for maybe one day in practice.
But that's not surprising. I mean, it's Penske.
No, not at all. But we go into Fast Friday, and it's the all Andretti show.
Yes. You know, and
the Andretti all stars come out.
Yeah, and it darn near was on pole day as well. I mean, yeah. Hinch is in second. Ryan Hunter-Reay is third. Marco is on the inside of row two in P4. And Anna qualified on the first day. She's in 13th. And even Sebastian Saavedra, who had an engine blow, headed down the front stretch and into turn one, saw this plume of blue smoke. How cool was that? I loved it. It sucked that it happened to my boy Sebastian. I really dig Sebastian Saavedra. I really like watching him drive. You know, so it sucked that it was him, but it was cool to see that element of risk and chance back in our sport.
Yeah.
You know, it belongs there. You need that. But anyway, they swapped out the engine and brought the car back out, and he was the last qualifier as they called it over the PA, the slowest qualifier on pole day. And I mentioned to my friend who was walking across from turn two with me, but he qualified.
Yeah.
You know, he did qualify on pole day. So he's in 24th. You know, so all the Andretti drivers were in the field on pole day, and the three full-time drivers, Hinch, Hunter-Reay, and Andretti in P2, 3, and 4, really remarkable showing, strong showing. I don't be surprised if one of those three walk away with the win here on Sunday. Do not be surprised at all.
No, I think that's a fair statement. That's a very fair statement.
How cool would it be to see Hinch in victory lane?
It would be very cool. It would be very cool to see Marco in victory lane.
Yes, that would be too.
He's been so good at Indy at times.
Well, I remember 2006. Oh, how gut-wrenching was that?
Yeah, how gut-wrenching that he threw that vicious block on Sam Hornish in turn three right in front of me. And he got it put right back in his face.
You do what you have to win, man. It's Indianapolis.
Yeah, that means put your foot in the accelerator and get through the last corners without letting Sam catch you. Anyway, you know, what I'm hinting at, though, is I'm wondering if there was a difference in how that additional boost treated the Honda and the Chevy engine. I'm wondering if that additional boost was more of a detriment or did not provide as much horsepower as it did for the Chevy engine. These are not equal platforms. This is not a matter of 1.5 extra bar equals this much horsepower for both engines. It's not a zero-sum game.
Right. You know, it's more – well, it's closer to the equivalence formulas that that sports car people have to worry about, right? And, you know, comparing you know, the 6-cylinder Porsches to the 12-cylinder, 10-cylinder Ferraris and, you know, very different engine architectures that they're having to manage and balance. And we've got a little bit of that here. You're absolutely right. There's going to be a difference in how the twin-turbo Chevrolet handles that additional allowable boost than the Honda. And certainly the Chevy is going to be a little bit more flexible in how it's able to handle that extra boost.
That's true. Yeah, and then beyond that, it shouldn't be a complete unknown because they have been running at higher boost levels on the road courses.
Right.
So it's not like they're saying, here's some extra boost, let's see what happens.
Right, you're not suddenly going to be blowing up cars.
But, you know, granted, though, on the road courses, except, say, for Sao Paulo, you haven't been running that sustained level of acceleration for long periods of time.
True.
Anyway, Tony Kanaan had a bit of an interesting day. He came out early and set some pretty quick times on his initial pole run or his initial qualifying run. Those were taken away because he didn't have a camera weight, a there's no camera there weight attached to his side.
He didn't
side
have proper ballast.
Yes, so they told him, let's try it again. Tony actually, when he got out of the car the second time, he was not a happy man because he was holding on for dear life to keep that car on the track.
Yeah.
It got treacherous over the course of the afternoon if you were trying to set quick times.
Yeah, yeah. It was super hot, and so the track was getting very greasy.
Yeah. It's so much so that when the KV cars went into the fast nine, KV, Tony Kanaan, and EJ Viso, they both didn't quite do qualifying runs in the fast nine.
No, they went out, did some laps, set good time, and then said, okay, that's it. You know, it is where we are.
Yeah. So they ended up qualifying eighth and ninth, and you probably understand from KV's perspective, if we're not going to go up much in the qualifying order, why risk the car?
Right, and you know, keep in perspective that if you're not going to get the pole, if you're not going to make the front row, it's a 500-mile race.
Yeah.
So you're already starting. You're guaranteed in one of the front three rows, and so you're going to be well clear of most of the likely carnage that would happen on the opening laps. I mean, Kogan is in the race, so you know you don't have to worry about him suddenly diving to one side, taking out two legends of motorsport simultaneously. You don't necessarily have that to worry about. So, why risk it? Be smart. Run a good race strategy and work your way up.
Kudos, like you said, kudos to Andretti. They did a fantastic job for qualifying. But those who did not came back on day two on the bumpless bump day.
Yes.
And just put it in the show. And that would be, you know, you got Sebastian Sveger who just switched engines. You got the two Foyt.
But he was in on pole day.
Was he?
Well, Sveger.
I've got the Sebastian Bourdais. I'm sorry.
Bourdais was Bourdais. The fastest qualifier on bump day.
Yeah. Sebastian Bourdais just switched engines. Wade Cunningham and Mike Conway. The Foyts didn't seem to do too well. Oriel Servia blew up his car in a wreck.
That was vicious.
Ed Carpenter did the same. Catherine Legg just switched engines. Brian Clausen blew up his car on pole day. And then you had the two Lotuses.
The Slotuses? So,
yeah, the Slotuses. The Louts. Anyway, it didn't make for a very interesting bump day. I didn't really pay much attention. I think the one thing I will say that bump day highlighted is how good Sebastian Bourdais' car looks in silver and black.
Oh, I know, man.
It looks better than the golden black, doesn't it?
That is a slick-looking car. That's a very slick-looking car. As it turns out, most of the times that he was out on track, I was in the pit shooting something or in the garages. And so I don't have a really good shot of him on track yet. I'm hoping to get that on Thursday and Friday. But yes, that is one seriously cool looking car.
Yeah, can't beat that. That's pretty phenomenal. yeah, other than that, that pretty much wraps up qualifying for the Indianapolis 500. So qualifying is over, and the IndyCar series announced something. We haven't seen this before. They announced $275,000 worth of post-qualifying fines.
What do you mean announced? Like they made public? They didn't keep it secret
exactly.
and do it behind closed doors?
Yeah. No double secret probation. The majority of them were given because of the caliper rules. It's been a practice for a long time to take the brake pads and retract them as much as you can so that you're not getting the friction and they're pulled away from the rotors so that you're not getting as much drag as well. That has been ruled out by the rule book, and they didn't tell a lot of people that, or they just chose not to listen when they were told, one or the other. But Ryan Briscoe got hit with that. Panther Racing got hit with it. Just a whole bunch of cars. And it's fairly interesting that that was one of the things that was going on. The other thing that was going on was FanForce United had something of a big fine. They had a $50,000 fine. Everybody else was getting $10,000 and $15,000. FanForce got $50,000, and theirs was for an infraction dealing with weight. Now, we're not sure exactly what was done there. Not sure if it was – yeah, don't know – whether they just didn't bolt in the driver equivalency weight or was it something to do with the engine weight, the additional weights that they have to strap on because the Lotus is lighter than the other engines. Not sure where that came from, but $50,000 is a very steep fine for a team that is barely existent at that.
You know, yeah, I don't know what to make of that. You know, strictly speaking, by the rule, what is it, $100,000 minimum for running without the ballast?
Yeah.
And so, you know, hey, they got cut some slack, you know, but you know, it's I mean, you break the rules, you pay the fine, pure and simple. But what I'm really, really happy about is that we're seeing these officiating decisions made in the full light of day. We're not seeing this done in the dark behind closed doors.
I was going to say, and add to that, and in the full light of day, shortly after the proceedings, and not, you know, not tomorrow. With NASCAR, you kind of have to wonder when they announce their penalties later in the week if there hasn't been some negotiating going on for the duration.
Yes, and you know, that it's been very decisive, very timely, and very consistent so far.
Doesn't matter who you are, because Andretti, doing so well in qualifying, they ended up getting five total fines. But then going the other way, they didn't play favorites with the team that was doing poorly and just pass by their fallacies as well. Everybody's got to be treated equal.
Being at the back of the grid is penalty enough, right? That would have been the Barnhart philosophy.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Yeah, that's exactly what it would have been. And I guess they did show some favoritism in that the rule book says $100,000.
Yeah. you know, so and you know, it's,
or should I say, some mercy?
Yeah, and I think that's it. They showed leniency. They showed you know, some, well, yeah, let's call it what it is. They showed some mercy.
Yeah.
Poor Lotuses. But anyway, it's good to see what Barnhart was, or I'm sorry, Barnhart, good grief, Bo Barfield was doing that day. And you know, I seeing him there at pit out as they were getting ready to go out, there was none of this grandstanding, give me four good ones crap. He was dressed professionally, slacks, dress shoes, shirt. He had a jacket on his way out, but, I mean, it's just too darn hot, right?
Yeah.
He looked like a proper professional. There on the grid, he he'd tell the teams, you've got 1 minute, get ready to go. And, you know, as soon as he got word that it was green, he would give them the signal, clear out, and boom, off they go. No grandstanding, no showboating, just proper straight up business. It was really nice to see.
I didn't even think about that. I saw one shot from Tech, and I saw him off to the side, and that was it.
And wasn't it nice?
It was refreshing. Yeah. Get out of the way and let the competitors be the stars.
Yes.
So, yeah. You know, and again, we mentioned this earlier, IndyCar at least entertained the idea of letting Lotus get some bonus boost for the race. And they decided that Lotus doesn't get a handout. And I'm perfectly happy with that. No real other points on that other than if they would have allowed it for Lotus, then you would be getting into ridiculous amounts of, what does it take? Well, can Honda come back and say, hey, you know, we're clearly not as good as the Chevys, so please give us something.
Yeah.
Well, you can have it on June whatever, 16th or whenever. Go right ahead. As for Lotus, if they make any changes to their engine, then I'll be shocked.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll all be surprised.
Well, I think on Trackside they mentioned that a lot of the teams, one of the things that really set them off against Lotus and really made them want to change their engine for the 500 was because when they asked Lotus, okay, we can deal with this until, you know, even through Indy and forward, just tell us what's coming down the pike, what's being planned for the updates to the engine package and everything, and Lotus said, frankly, not much. So
updates. What
updates? We have decals.
Yeah. We have toasters.
Toasters. I was gonna go there. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah,
Judd sitting there looking at all we got are these IOUs.
Nice. Yeah, indeed. This weekend we did draw national attention because our very own AP writer Jenna Fryer, who also is a a NASCAR writer. She put out a piece regarding the Indianapolis 500 and the buildup. Dateline, Charlotte, North Carolina. But it didn't treat anything that's going on with IndyCar with kid gloves. Not at all.
And, you know, she's caught a lot of flack about this article. Again, mm-hmm. You know, the Twitter sphere has erupted. However, you know, I read through this and I think is this anything more than what a lot of bloggers are saying?
Oh no.
You know, it's certainly much more professionally written and actually wordsmith as opposed to what we do. You know, some people have taken umbrage to the term word butchers.
Yes.
I'll own up. I am by no means a fine crafter of words. I try my best, but you know, it's not my profession. My skill in word crafting, doesn't go towards the style that one would need for a journalistic article. It would go more towards a very terse, precise thing you would need for a science article, which is going to put anyone to sleep within 3 seconds of reading one of my articles. Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't want to say, as I say, that the tone is very much like what a lot of bloggers are saying. I don't mean that to say that her writing is amateurish. Not at all. You know, it's very professional, but it makes a lot of the same points and casts the very critical eye that a lot of others, including us, have been casting. So I think the angst against her is unfair and uncalled for. It's she's calling it what it is, and you know, if people don't like it, well, they don't have to.
I would say
truth hurts.
Yeah, that's true. Her article is a summary of why I you know, I told you this before, why I was not very interested in what happened this weekend.
Yeah.
I was interested to see who got the pole, but the rest of it, I could care less. I probably would feel a little different if I were at the track this weekend. Unfortunately, I couldn't. But it was a good summary of everything that's going on, of the issues with Lotus, of the issues with Lotus, of the issues with Lotus. talking about how upset a certain Roger Penske is with the current administration because his Chevy appeal was turned down, and basically how he feels the league handled that one poorly because Chevy and the other IndyCar Honda teams, or excuse me, the IndyCar Chevy teams, did not find out about the change in the turbo until like a week before they unveiled it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, we just got done talking about seeing race officiating decisions made in the clear light of day. The same is starting to evolve on the tech side, but it's lagging behind a little bit, I think. And this is a clear outcome of that.
Yeah. Well, and then beyond it, you know, there's the good with the bad. You got the talk about Rubens Barrichello, but then also tempering that with John Alesi. You've got some other interesting things that they bring up, possibly about a rumored owner revolt trying to get Randy Bernard replaced. I mean, everything's in this article, and it's not pulling any you know, it's not putting on kid gloves. It's not pulling any punches. It's just laying out a bunch of facts in a well, concisely written article.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I read through this article, and my first thought was, that's a lot like what something Robin Miller would write.
Yes.
It really was. Yes. I mean, without, you know, Robin's vitriol, this is the kind of article he would write. So
if it were properly crafted and it's built good and professional manner.
Yeah. I think in the end, you get what you get when you get an AP writer, because they are interested in selling papers. They're interested in selling articles.
Right.
Jenna is doing exactly what she's supposed to do. I have no bone of contention with her. In fact, I think IndyCar got what they deserved because they've been doing some pretty funky things leading up to this year's 500, and hopefully this kind of national exposure through the AP will change some of those practices that kind of got us where we're at. So
yeah.
Going forward, I'm hoping that this will be a good thing for IndyCar. I'm also a little bit less than enthused with Jenna's reception by the IndyCar track forumites. I find it rather ridiculous that all she gets is vitriol for coming out and being national media exposure.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, I mean, really, do you expect them to be positive about anything?
No, I don't. It's
okay.
Rather funny.
Well, there you are.
Rather funny. Anyway, I think how it works is that, you know, It's not that everybody on track forum is negative about everything. It's just they rotate when they're negative. So there's always like at least six or seven people on there that are always negative. It's just that they rotate when they're negative. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And you hit the ignore button on the rest of them. Anyway, let's go ahead and talk about the 500. In its glorious light, we need to talk about who will win the Indy 500 this season.
Wow. I don't think it's going to be Briscoe.
No, I think that that's fair. He got the pole, but...
How cool would it be to see Newgarden win it?
Oof,
I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't know.
Cool,
I think the Chevys are just going to be out there dominating this race.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, I got to think that... I still like Elio. I really do. In spite of how he did on pole day, I still like Elio for the race. And I think he's going to be my pick. Although my backup to that, and toss a coin here, Hinchcliffe or Andretti?
Mm. Wow.
I think it's going to be one of those three, but my favorite is going to be Castroneves. It all depends on how the incidents play out, how the yellows catch all the drivers in their sequence, who gets caught out, who gets the great benefit, and all that. And so, you know, it's going to come down to strategy, because all three of them have the ability to win this. They have the speed, and especially Marco and Castroneves, they have proven they have the racecraft at Indianapolis. And maybe I'm giving Castroneves the edge just because, yeah, I kind of want to see him win four. I think that would be cool to see that happen.
Wow. Okay, so you're calling Elio for the win. Place?
Oh, place. Elio for the win. You know, here's the thing. It's not going to be Hinch and Andretti second and third. It's going to be one or the other. And the other is going to... man. Let me say Andretti. So, Castroneves, Andretti, power. There's my win place show.
Okay. Sir, I'm going to go with a different arrangement. I think Marco's going to win.
Okay.
I think he's had solid practice times and solid qualifying. Solid month for Marco. Hildebrand is going to be second because Panther's always
second.
Panther.
Did you see what your favorite driver said about the Panther-Dryan-Reinbolt merger?
No, I did not.
It was hilarious. He said that the team has come in second place, not twice in a row, but four times in a row now? And so obviously they need help.
Funny. So then I'm going to go for Elio for third.
So you got Andretti, Hildebrand, and Elio.
Yes. First out. This is easy.
No, it's not. I tell you what, it's not going to be the Lotuses.
Oh, yeah.
No. It won't be the Lotuses. It's going to be a crash. And, yeah, I think Railroad's got the right of this. I really do. That there's going to be an early race, first few laps incident. It's going to take somebody out. And
where's Thomas Schechter when you need a scapegoat?
I think it's going to be Michel Jourdain.
Ooh, that's a good pick.
I mean, he's in that sketchy part of the grid.
Yeah,
where things can occur real quick.
You know, but the thing about that part of the grid is you look at that part of the grid and.
I can also see it being, and I hate to say this, but I can see it being Saavedra.
I was going to say,
he's going to be in a faster car than those in front of him, I think. And so I think he's going to, he's an excitable kid. And I think he might overreach on cold tires, on a cold, track won't be cold, will it? On a greasy track.
Yeah.
And,
on a blazing inferno of black asphalt.
Yeah. I'm on fire. No, literally.
Just like Michel Jourdain this weekend.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah.
I'm tempted to go for Wade Cunningham for first out. Tempted.
Yeah.
But
he's got a lot of experience at the track, man.
That's fair. I'm still tempted. But Jean Alesi is going to get my first out.
Really?
Because
You think he's going to do a parade lap and park it?
No, I don't think that. But I think he's going to be escorted from the premises before we get a yellow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bet. Do you bet on the slowest Lotus or do you bet on an early wreck? And it may be the early wreck, but I'm gonna bet on the Lotus.
Okay, fair enough.
So
you're betting no yellow and Jean Alesi.
Yeah. And you're betting?
I still think I'm going to go with Michel Jourdain. I think as people try to pass him, he goes too low, hits the white line, and loses it.
And Sean's picks are just Jim Catherine Legg to win the race.
Nice.
Jake's for second.
Oh, really? Oh, I was going to say Simona for second, and Jean Lacy to show.
Ooh, that'd be better. And first out would have to be Bo Bearfield.
Yes. I was going to say Tony Kanaan, but no.
We're not going to go there.
He might actually get a point.
Oof. Ouch.
Yeah,
I don't want that.
I don't either. He just doesn't seem to have great luck at India. It sucks. Yeah.
Well, before we move on from the IndyCar segment of the program, we do have to talk about Bob Jenkins. He had announced at the Old Timers event the other night that he is stepping down from broadcasting after the Indy 500 is over because his wife has been found to have brain cancer. So here in Open Paddock and across the racing world, you've got a lot of people who have their thoughts and prayers pointed towards your family, Bob. We appreciate what you've done for the sport, and it's going to be hard to see it without you, because you are a voice that draws my mind towards IndyCar. So,
well, in motorsport,
I'll do what's best for your family, Bob. You have our thoughts and prayers behind you, and we hope to see you back, and hope your wife fully recovers.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to miss you from the broadcast for sure.
And no easy way to segue, but we do need to talk about the Moss Road Indy night before the 500 coming up this weekend, and then also the Freedom 100. And Doug, you will be in attendance at all events, so please.
Absolutely, I'm looking forward to this. And in fact, since I'm not going to have my normal posse to hang with there in turn one, mm-hmm. Michael.
Yeah. Sorry.
I think my wife is going to stay here and get some rest since we get up so early to go to the track on race day.
Yeah.
It's just going to be my friend and I headed to the night before the 500, and I think we're going to spring for the pit passes. And,
sweet.
Yeah, and watch the races and qualifying from there. So that'll be kind of cool. That'll be kind of cool. Looking forward to seeing the Star Mazda and the USF 2000 drivers compete for the first time this season. You know, I hadn't seen them compete. I hadn't seen Star Mazda live since Iowa last year, and the USF 2000 since Mid-Ohio last year. So I'm jonesing for some Mazda Road Indy action, man. It's been too long. And even longer. Iowa for the Firestone Indy Lights that I get to see on Thursday and Friday. Very excited. The Star Mazda field looks like it's going to be about what it was, what it's been previously, looking at around high teens, low 20s type of car count. So that'll be perfect for the 5/8 mile oval at Lucas Oil Raceway. I haven't seen the entry list for USF 2000 yet. If it continues anything like the previous events, are we looking at maybe 33 USF 2000 cars at Lucas Oil Raceway? Man,
very cool.
that will be some dicey racing, I tell you. That'll be dicey and exciting. It'll be very exciting. And because of that, man, who do you pick? I mean, Spencer Pigot and Matthew Brabhams have been lightning fast. Both of them, they've just been kind of trading off wins. Are they able to maintain that? I know this will be Brabham's first time competing on an oval. He did very well in testing, but testing, that's practice. Practice. It's not the same as race day, especially if you've got 30 some odd cars in two classes. It'll be very, very interesting. I don't know who to pick for that. I couldn't honestly tell you. You have to kind of give the edge automatically to Pigot and Brabs, but man, there's just so much variance possible that you know, it's hard to say, you know, it's going to be one of these people. You know, it might not be any of the normal top runners, so it'll be exciting to say the least. Star Mazda, I mean, it's been a while since we've had a significant, well, I don't want to say significant, when we've had a large field of cars at an oval. But, you know, the Petri Svanto and Sage Karam, they did remarkably well, as did Zach Beach, who has a new sponsor, by the way. And this is cool, and I'll get to this here in a second. I want to talk first about the race, but it remind me to get back to his sponsor. They did very well in testing, and so all three of them have experience. Sage and Zach have experience on oval tracks in these cars. Svanto, of course, is coming in from USF 2000. Connor DeFilippi, also potentially a strong contender. We'll see, but you know, I really think it's one of the Andretti boys that has the potential to really run out and win this. Svanto may be fast in a lap there in testing, but you know those Star Mazda machines, you've got to maintain momentum lap after lap after lap. You've got to be dead on consistent. You've really got to manage that momentum more so than you do with the USF 2000 cars, just because of the difference in the engine architecture. The fact that it's a rotary engine. You know, you really have to keep the revs up. If you drop the revs, you know, you're fighting a while to get back up to speed. So, I think my picks for that are going to be, either Sage or Zach Beach. Likely Sage. I think he has the more experience in these machines, than his teammate. But anyway, getting back to, Beach's sponsor, K-12, the nation's largest provider of proprietary curriculum and online education programs, is going to be sponsoring his car. They do a lot for not only for schools but also for homeschool. Homeschool, yeah. Of course, and a lot of public schools are starting to offer more and more online courses for students. Well, like Zach, who needed more flexibility. You know, the kid was racing professional race cars for a living while he was still in high school. So this is a great fit for him. And I know he was taking a lot of online courses to finish up his education. So this is one of those I'm not just a spokesman, I'm also the president type of thing.
Yeah.
this is something where he has some experience and some investment in this type of stuff. So this is one of the best sponsorship fits I've seen in a long time. Maybe that's coming off because I'm a bit of a I'm not a bit of a teacher. I am a teacher.
You're a bit of an education junkie.
Yes, I am an education junkie. That caught my eye at first. But no, really, this is a fantastic fit. Looking forward to seeing how this develops. And it'd be cool to see them roll in some motorsports influence into the science and mathematics curriculum. So we'll see how that develops. At any rate, it's all very, very cool. Now, in terms of Indy Lights, practice and qualifying begin on Thursday at the Speedway. Make sure you come out. Hopefully, it's not slated to thunder down buckets and buckets of water like it did last year. Unfortunately, it's going to be hotter than blazes. So we should have a green track all day. Should have good qualifying, good practice runs. And like I said, I love watching these cars go around IMS, especially with these young drivers. It's very, very exciting. We've got we're probably going to see about 20 cars on the grid. We've got a few returning veterans and a few new drivers. Peter Dempsey is first we'll talk about here. He returns to the grid with Unesi Racing, and thankfully, Roden is not taking the grid at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and they're just going to have one entry. Peter Dempsey is going to run that. Ordinarily, I would say, okay, you know, they don't got a chance. But he's being reunited with Dave McMillan, his engineer, from back when he was with O2 Racing Technologies, before all the brouhaha that erupted at Milwaukee last year. So, they've got a quality engineer who has experience working with Peter. So I'm not expecting them to be out in front, but they're not going to be at the back of the grid, which is exactly where Roden would be if he were driving the car. So I'm looking for him to put in a good finish, easily top 10, and I won't be surprised at all to see him run top 5. Another returning veteran, another driver it's really nice to see back on the grid, is Anders Krohn. He's going to be with the Brian Herta Autosport squad there at Indianapolis. So far, I don't think anything beyond that, but at least for Indianapolis. We've spoken to Anders on a couple of occasions, seeing what he's got going for this year. And he's really been working hard to try to find some sort of some seat time. In the meantime, he's been working really hard off the track, trying to get new up and coming drivers on the track, including Henrik Ferruseth, who's competing with Cape Motorsports with Wayne Taylor Racing in the USF 2000 National Championship in the national class. I think he's running a Formula Continental chassis, an FC chassis. But anyway, so it's not like he's been idle. He's certainly been very busy and very involved in motorsports. Just hadn't had an opportunity to be behind the wheel all that often, although he's going to get that opportunity again, and hopefully a chance to redeem himself after last year. If you remember, he had that spin as they were coming to take the grid green after a caution period. He was leading the race and spun there coming out of turn 4 on cold tires. So gutted. But anyway, we'll see how that goes. Lastly, Chase Austin is coming back to Indy Lights. He had been running for Davey Hamilton Racing. Not Davey Hamilton. He was running with Will Q Ribbs' team last year. But this year, he's going to be with Juncos Racing, teammate with JB Horto, who will be running at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the first time as well. Juncos Racing, of course, very, very successful team in Star Mazda. They came in and quickly became one of the top contenders, not unlike what Team Pelfrey has been doing in Star Mazda recently. But this is their first season in Indy Lights. They've struggled a little bit to find speed, to come to grips with this Dallara chassis and the engine. The whole machine, and in fact, they didn't make the Long Beach race. They sat out Long Beach, so I'd like to see them do well. But this first year, I think really just needs to be treated as a kind of a shakedown year for them, as they figure out this machine and where they can find speed. And I think next year, once they've had a season's worth of experience, I would not be surprised at all to see them really come up strong and be contenders in 2013. Not so much this year, though. But it's good to see Chase Austin you know, with a ride and still pursuing that dream of eventually making it to the Eyesight IndyCar Series. We'll see how that goes. Couple other new drivers, one for Bilardi Auto Racing, Mike Larrison, and Emerson Newton-John for FanForce United. Not expecting them to be contenders. But again, it's good to see new drivers coming to the series, getting experience, and providing more action for us to watch than just what's happening at the front. You know, the more drivers we have, the more battles we have on track, the more entertaining it is for us. And I will say it's a benefit to the competitors as well, as they have more opportunity to hone racecraft. So just because they're not at the front doesn't mean that they're not gaining very valuable experience and learning some very valuable lessons. So we'll see how that keeps going. Who's going to win? Wow. You know, of course, in the first three road courses at St. Pete, Barber, and Long Beach, we had three different winners. We had Tristan Poitier, and then Esteban Guerrieri, and Sebastian Saavedra. All three have been on the podium. There's been no one else on the podium but those three, and they've just kind of swapped places each race. Now, what the difference has been is the bonus points. And right now, Sebastian Saavedra has one more bonus point than his competitors. In fact, one more than Tristan, and two more than Guerrieri. Esteban has, I had it written here. I don't. I apologize. I don't have the actual point numbers. But there's 1 point from Sebastian to Poitier, and then 1 point from Poitier to Esteban, and then a crap ton of points back to P4. You know, so which one's going to win? Man, I don't know. I am inclined to rule out Poitier, since this is his – he's done well at ovals, but this is his very first time at Indianapolis, and Indianapolis is not your normal oval. It's a very different beast, and it's at speeds in these cars. And, you know, they're doing 190-plus. Might not be quite that fast given the heat that we're likely to see, but still, it's a sustained level of speed that Tristan has not had a whole lot of experience with, and I think that'll prevent him from securing the victory. Esteban, however, can win here. He led a couple laps last year and was just 0.4 seconds shy of the win. Losing to his teammate Joseph Newgarden, he came in P2. Esteban has had some issues with consistency last year. I think he's really come to grips with those this season, or at least he seems to have. And if he can keep it between, you know, off the walls, then I think he has a good shot at it. But my pick, I think the favorite has to be Sebastian Saavedra. He's back with Andretti Auto Force and AFS Racing. And, of course, this is not just for the Firestone Freedom 100, but also for the Indianapolis 500. So I'm trying to think if there's ever been anyone who has actually done that. Well, Sebastian did the double last year, didn't he? No. It was the year before when he was with Brian Herta Autosport, and he was also with Brian Herta in the 500 in that William Rast car. When he ended up finding out that he made the field while he was in the hospital after that brutal bump day crash that he had. But anyway, he has a lot of experience here at the track. He has a lot of experience being at the front at this track. If you remember that, what was it, 2009, he had an amazing battle with his then-teammate J.R. Hildebrand. They went at it hammer and tongs, you know, back and forth. JR ended up edging him out at the end, but doggone it, it was a great battle. And I think Saavedra really has to be the odds-on favorite for winning this year's Fire 7 Freedom 100. Some other quick carb day notes. You know, of course, if you can come out to the track on Thursday and Friday, carb day is always a ton of fun. I think you'll find that the shady side of the track, you know, the outside of the track will be jam packed with people. I don't think we're going to sit in our usual spot there in the paddock terrace. You know, the seats above the F1 garages. That's usually where we say, I don't think we're going to sit there this year. We're going to find some shade. But on carb days, especially, there's going to be a tweet up. The Brian Herta Autosport team is having their carb day tweet up over at the IndyCar Fan Village. Brian Herta and Steve Newey, owners of Brian Herta Autosport, will be there along with Tagliani and potentially a couple others. They're going to have all kinds of prizes, giveaways, and goodies and stuff like that. If you haven't, if you don't already follow the team on Twitter, look them up at BHA and search through their tweets. You'll find a link to their Tweetbyte where you can register. You don't need to register; you can just come. But they've got some goodies for the first few people that do. We've also got a link. Check out my my first quarter recap and Firestone Freedom 100 preview article there on openpaddock.net. I've got a link to their Tweetbyte site there. So anyway, should be a lot of fun.
Cool.
And Lynyrd Skynyrd is doing the concert.
Nice. That should make for some very drunk people.
Yes. Given that he's taking it badly.
Yeah, very badly. Ugh. Well, going out of the IndyCar world, we just have a few minor topics to cover before we wrap up the show. The World of Rally, the World Rally Championship, otherwise known as Sebastian Loeb's playground, they're heading into the Acropolis Rally this weekend in Greece, and it's pretty hard to say that Loeb is going to, you know, miss his stride here. As you and I were joking before the show, Loeb wins. One of the Ford boys, most likely Solberg, finishes second, and the other one crashes out.
Yeah, I'll give you two guesses as to who that's going to be.
Yeah. See, poor Mitchell. Anyway, yeah, I'm not much into the WRC, so if you have anything further you want to mention about the Acropolis Rally, go right ahead.
Well, you know, the only thing that's going to stop Loeb from winning here is if he pulls a Portugal and ends up having to, you know, if he has an off or a mechanical that forces him to withdraw. I don't foresee that happening. I think he takes the rally win. Does he take the power stage? Maybe not. That probably goes to Petter or his teammate, Mikko. Mikko's be really good at those. But, you know, Mikko's been somewhat consistent, but not as fast as you would expect him to be in the Citroën. He should be a lot faster. you know, he should be soundly trouncing the Ford of Petter Solberg, and he just isn't.
Yeah.
You know, so he's behind Petter by 3 points in the championship because of it. I think, again, one of the people to keep an eye on, one of the surprises might be Mads Osberg. He's been reasonably consistent. And, well, as we saw at Portugal, kind of a surprise, you know. He took the win. And so I don't think he's going to do that again, not without the help that he had at Portugal with both Mikko and Sebastian having retirements. Yari Matti and... I have a love-hate relationship, you know, with Yari Matti, you know. He's exciting to watch. I really dig the guy, but doggone it, he's just erratic. You know, keep it on the gravel, man. You know, don't get crazy. Just keep it on the road and bring it home. I don't know if he's trying to push too much intimidation from his teammate or what the deal is, but man, he is just not able to hold it together. He had the one win at Sweden, and other than that, he's only scored 2 points. He didn't even go to Argentina, I don't think. And so, Yari Matty, you got to step it up, man. Gotta start upping your game, or at least just bringing the car home and scoring some points. Because right now the manufacturer's title, forget about it. I mean, just forget about it. We're looking at 151 to 106 Citroen over the Ford World Rally Team.
We're fighting for second in the world championship, the drivers' championship. No, not, that's it. I mean, forget about anybody other than Loeb winning this, and then just squabble amongst yourselves as to who can be the least inconsistent.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Who can be the least inconsistent? So yeah, we'll see how that turns out. Again, this is happening the same weekend as the 500. So forgive me. I'm going to be paying attention to the 500. I'll have to read about the Acropolis Rally later.
It'll be on my DVR when I get home on Monday night, and yeah. I might get to it somewhere around
Wednesday,
middle of the week.
Thursday.
Yeah, because when I get home, I'm going to watch Monaco. So you
exactly,
know
exactly. Anyway, I wish I was independently wealthy, didn't have to go to work, so I could sit and watch all the racing that I want to watch that's sitting on my DVR. I still have the Pirelli, the SCCA World Challenge races that I still need to watch. They're sitting on my DVR. I haven't gotten around to it yet.
See, I need to just go to their site and watch the full race broadcast instead of, they do a good job getting it on television and everything, but it's a sprint race. It's made to be a televisable race.
Yes.
And yet they cram two races into a one-hour block with 30 minutes of puff piece at the beginning of it. I'm sorry. That's not interesting to me. I want to see the full race broadcast, and I could care less about your human interest stories, which pretty much are the only thing you're doing on those broadcasts. So anyway, okay, we need to move on. Sorry about just throwing –
that's okay.
World Challenge under the bus and driving on by, I'm doing a gangland style. Okay, we're jumping in the world of F1, and we're going to briefly hit a couple of the issues that are facing future tracks. First of all, the Austin Statesman newspaper has filed a plea in the Texas State Court District in an attempt to access legal documents sealed by the Circuit of the Americas. Huh? Breaks down. Remember, Circuit of the Americas has been sued by Tavo Helmond. Remember, Tavo was ousted from the group, and Circuit of the Americas went directly to FOM and got their race contract, where Tavo was initially the go-between. Mm-hmm. Tavo is suing for lots of money because he was supposed to get lots of money in his position with the group. Okay, so the Austin Statesman has filed basically a Freedom of Information Act type deal to try and get information about what the heck is going on with this lawsuit. Their reasoning is pretty sound. You're talking about giving a bunch of the taxpayers' money to this event over the course of its 10-year contract. We at least need to know what's going on. Why are these documents sealed by the Circuit of the Americas? Why are these legal documents not available for the public to see? I don't have a bone to pick on either side of this. I just think it's very interesting that these kind of things keep coming up with this Austin track.
Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't derail it is the main concern.
Yeah. If they're on schedule now, and I think on some things are ahead of schedule, and if it maintains, then we should be good for November. But
ticketing, way behind schedule.
Oh well, yes, ticketing is way behind schedule, way behind schedule. But I mean, you have enough notice out there. People know about the event. They're just waiting to pull the trigger on tickets. So that's not as much of a concern. My concern was the construction timeline. That's what I was thinking about, getting the actual physical track ready, you know, so we don't have to do this 2 week fast cure, you know, tarmac layman did at Korea. if there's a little bobble here, you know, it's not going to take much. If there's just a little snag that causes a 2 week, 3 week work delay, all of a sudden now you're scrambling, right?
Yeah.
Now you're seriously under the gun. I mean, the timing, they're on track, but the timing is so tight, nothing can go wrong. And if it does, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and there's, coming from the construction industry, there's only so much you can do with a construction schedule. One of the guys I work with today told me a saying that makes so much sense when it comes to construction. It takes one woman 9 months to have a baby. It doesn't take nine women 1 month each to have a baby. You can only get so many warm bodies into one space working on things before the productivity goes way down.
Yeah.
So that's why construction schedules exist, and usually construction schedules are written in such a way that the job can be done as efficiently as possible.
Yeah. You know, that's a very good analogy. You know, it's just throwing more man hours at it isn't necessarily going to solve the issue if
indeed
there's only, you know, a certain number of them that can do it at a time.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that, we're looking at kind of the same issue with the Russian Grand Prix in Sochi. Now, I'm not as concerned about this one because the race is scheduled for 2014. It's not this year. It's not next year. It's the year after.
I'm not worried about it happening or not.
Yeah, honestly,
truth be honest,
who cares? But this is important to F1, so we're going to briefly discuss it. Similar to what happened in France, there's been a government reshuffling in the region around Sochi, and a lot of the originators and supporters of the F1 project have lost their jobs. And because of that, construction work is, you know, the quote, this is from ESPN F1's article, construction work is said to have ground to a halt, prompting concerns the Russian Grand Prix will be postponed if not called off. That's a concern for Bernie because he's looking for, you know, making this race schedule go larger and larger and larger. And as they're trying to float, you know, some of the shares of F1 on the stock exchange or on the Singaporean stock exchange, what they don't want is things like this devaluing that initial offering.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a concern. But you, as you said, it's not a big concern to me because, well, if Russia gets on the schedule, who do we lose? Hopefully it's Bahrain, but most likely it's, you know, Monza.
Right. Yeah.
Way things are going. Now, the other one that's just interesting to note, we still haven't heard anything about the New Jersey Grand Prix about their funding. It's said to be completely privately funded. As of yet, there's no details of that private funding, prompting a lot of people to be concerned about there actually being funding for said event. However, construction is ongoing. No matter what Bernie says about possibly pushing it back to 2014, supposedly construction is ongoing and it's on track. So we shall see. A lot of new events and a lot of concerns going along with them, but in the end, I'm still excited about what we're seeing in F1 this year.
It is exciting. Why is it exciting? We could talk about that until, you know, we're blue in the face. You know, is it proper competition? Is it not proper competition? You know, the DRS seems to have less of an impact this year. It mm-hmm. still does. I mean, we saw some DRS passes, certainly last race. But the big story is tires, and tires are the same for everybody. And
but they're not the same week to week.
Well, that's
well,
okay.
They are. It's just, I think one of the Ferrari team members basically said, what is this deciding factor in F1 this year is track temperature.
Yeah, well, who can manage that the best? It's not the track temperature that makes the decision. It's the team engineers and the drivers mm-hmm. that make
setting up for
that, right, that adapt to the track temperatures. You know, so again, it's the same environmental conditions, it's the same tire conditions for everybody. who adapts best that particular weekend. And, you know, because of that, we've seen this great mix-up on the grid, and it's been brilliant. I love it. You know, there's been a lot of people that have been complaining about it, Schumacher. But, you know, I say this is exactly what we need. This is exactly what we need to see in F1 is excitement and competition.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's got to be good for business. That's got to raise the value.
Yeah. And speaking of value, CVC, the owner of said Formula One group, or they up till recently have owned about 63% of Formula One.
Did you just break something?
No. Sorry, my wife's phone is going off.
She has to bring Dennis to class next time.
Formula One's, Formula One has an interesting deal going on. CVC owns 63% of Formula One, and they are selling that. They're selling off shares down to about 40%. That would put their the sale price at about $1.6 billion. And it looks like, Waddell Reed BlackRock and Norway's Norges Bank Investment Management have both bought into Formula One. So CVC's selling, but they're selling to other investment groups. So don't look for any big changes in the way the Concorde Agreement is structured anytime soon. Because it's going to be structured so that there's money to be had for the investors. And less of that money will continue to be rolled back into developing the sport. One could argue, though, what do they really need to develop? Because, my goodness, they own the motorsports world. and no other indication can be given other than they're going to Monaco this weekend, and they can still get people to watch this race.
Yeah.
In a year in F1 when overtaking is going to be, you know, not at a premium, when tires are having such a big impact on the racing, we're seeing passing at circuits that we don't see passing at normally. We're going to Monaco where we don't see passing. And it doesn't matter what you do with a DRS or crappy tires or really good tires.
Wait.
Where can you pass?
There's a couple potential places where you can pass if you're talking about huge differences in grip level and tires. And I think not to beat a dead horse, but tire management is going to be key. And, you know, I think potentially we could see passing in turn one. It's the end of the front curve.
Mm-hmm.
Can't call it front straight, but front curve. Headed turn one, might see a couple passes there. Someone maybe goes a little wide, you know, not having as much grip as they expected or as they had last lap through. And of course, you can see some passing coming out of the tunnel and into the bus stop. You know, really, that is it, isn't it? Well, unless you're Lewis Hamilton and you can pass there in the carousel. Or in the hairpin. Oh man, I couldn't believe you did that. That was awesome. There are a couple of legitimate places, but they're going to require exactly the right conditions. But with as strong as the degradation has been with the Pirelli tires, I think we could see it. I don't think this is going to be the normal parade that you usually see with the Monaco Grand Prix. Mm.
Yeah, I obviously have to reserve judgment until I see the race, but I'm not as optimistic as you are.
And okay.
We'll just wait and see. Say that too much, I think. But for the winner of the race, that's all we're going to mention. But who do you take for the win, Doug? I think I am going to go with Lewis Hamilton.
Man, you know, Lewis has shown to be better this year at managing tires than he has been in the past. So that's really not too bad of a pick. However, I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be more important than what his newfound skills,
what he's capable of.
Yes. And I'm torn between his teammate Button, and
You know you want to pick Alonzo.
I do. I do want to pick Alonzo. I almost said Vettel. I do like Vettel, but I don't think, you know, man, I'm surprised. I still don't think the Red Bull really has it together yet. They're missing something in their setup, in their design. I don't know what it is. There's something not right.
110-degree air temperature seems to be what they're missing.
True. Yes. They always did do well in the heat. But, no, you know, Alonso showing what he could do when grip was critical. I do like Alonso at a circuit like Monaco.
It certainly seems to mitigate the damage that the Ferrari chassis is doing to his lap times.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps up the show. Do you have any saved rounds, any last bullets?
I do have one real quick thing. You know, in IndyCar, the series has struggled for a number of years with teams and drivers trying to maintain sponsorship, trying to keep an influx of new sponsors and new money coming to the series, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, we've always said that you know, if we want to encourage a sponsor to participate in the sport that we love, we need to support that sponsor. You know, we've done this with Menards in the past. We've done this with Dollar General, and you know, all the other various companies that have you know, paid good money and lots of money to put their name on the sides of the racing machines we love to watch. Fuzzy's Vodka, of course, sponsoring a fan favorite, Ed Carpenter and Ed Carpenter Racing, is right up there with him, right?
And a Doug favorite sponsor at that.
Oh yes, absolutely, it's fantastic stuff. Well, I had the good opportunity to make it up to Crown Liquors at 106 and in Michigan this afternoon, and got a bottle of Fuzzy's Vodka autographed by Fuzzy Zeller. And what a great guy. You know, he was cool as the other side of the pillow. He really was. It was fantastic. So got my autographed bottle of Fuzzy's. I'm thinking, do I want to drink that, or do I just want to leave that intact? I might drink it. I mean, the autograph isn't going to go away just because I drank the vodka, right?
Right.
But anyway, they're doing a number of signings, both Fuzzy and Ed Carpenter, around the Indianapolis metro area. So if you're around Indianapolis, check out their Facebook page. I put up a little article of my experience from this afternoon. I've got a link there to their Facebook page where you can check the schedule of upcoming signing events. And if you go, make sure you tell them how much you appreciate their support of the iZotto IndyCar series. And regardless of what series is your favorite, if you ever run into someone who's involved in the sponsorship of one of your favorite teams, drivers, cars, or series in general, make sure to thank them and let them know that you are making purchasing decisions based on their involvement. I mean, that's what it's all about for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you have to have a return on investment, or it's not an investment. It's right. A charity.
Right.
And that's the last thing IndyCar wants to be, is a charity. Though, unfortunately, I think for several years running, it has been something of a charity.
Yes, it has. You know, there. You can make the argument there's been some, you know, what you're really selling isn't the advertising aspect of it, more than the business-to-business side of it, the hospitality side of it. But, you know, whatever, there needs to be more return on investment. And, you know, it's one of those things that's a small thing, but, you know, we can be part of that by letting people know that we appreciate their involvement and making purchasing decisions based on that.
And I do have to make one comment. No matter how many times, Izod, I'm talking to you, no matter how many times you show me that shirt, that black, green, yellow, and white shirt in that commercial, I'm not buying that.
Not buying it. They make some idiot. Very that's cool. Idiot. They make some very cool shirts. That's not
they
one.
They make some very cool shirts, but you will never catch me in that one.
No, that's not one of them.
Anyway, well, I think that that pretty much wraps up the show for this evening. Look forward to us next week. We are going to be talking about the 500. We might talk about Monaco. We might talk about Rally. We are going to be talking about the 500, and I'm looking forward to a barn burner of a race because, well,
burner
no pun
is
in,
right.
Yeah, no pun intended. It's shaping up to be a very good race, aside from the issues we had with Lotus going into this last week and a half. It's great that we're past that now. The qualifying is done. The field is set. We can look forward to the race and not think about these issues again. We just get to see a great race. So here's to Indy. Good night, everybody.
Good night.